Hello, fellow fiends. Welcome to another episode of Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces. I am your host, Cassiopeia. I'm super excited because I actually got a new desk. I've actually had it for a couple of weeks now, I think a couple of past episodes, at least with season six. I've had it. I'm still trying to figure out lighting in my little studio here, so bear with me because that's still kind of being worked out, but right now I guess it works. Also, please disregard the mess that is me. I've been a little under the weather, also been working a lot this week, but I wanted to bring you a new episode because I didn't get to bring you one last week, so I wanted to make sure that, yay, you have a new episode. I'll also be starting school in a couple of months, so I'm super excited about that. Yay me! But don't worry, I will definitely still be able to bring you new and creepy and spooky content. So, yay! Don't forget, you can catch me every Friday with brand new episodes on your favorite podcast platform and now YouTube as well. So be sure that you check that out. I'll throw the link in the show notes and also in the credits. If you subscribe to Patreon or Anchor, you get bonus episodes every other Tuesday and also a merchandise discount and also a thank you swag box of Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces merchandise. I understand that sometimes times are tough, but you still want to support your favorite content creators. So I do have a Cash App and a Venmo, and I'll throw those up on the screen so you can see that. Every little bit helps, even if it's just a dollar here, a dollar there. And it's very appreciated because it helps me bring content to you. Also, just buying merchandise in the Creepy Cases, or actually it's the Wiccan Fae shop on pizzaandpigtails.com. Just click up on Wiccan Fae and it has the Creepy Cases Spooky Spaces merchandise. It has the Wiccan Fae candles. It also has the Creepy Cases Spooky Spaces candles. It has a couple of little different things on there. So definitely check it out. And then also support by liking, commenting, following on social media, sharing, getting the podcast out there is a great way to help support and help bring more attention and help bring more, you know, exposure. And it's always, once again, appreciated. Also, if you are a small business like myself or a big business and you'd like to get your products and content shared with the world, definitely reach out to me, creepycases.spookyspaces@gmail.com. I have some ad space on the podcast. So without further ado, and now that the business side is out of the way, let's get into that case that I have for you today. I actually have a sort of a double whammy for you today. What started out as the disappearance of an 18-year-old man in 2000 ended up a quadruple murder by 2017. A story that has many twists and turns and so many different branches being told that it's actually difficult to tell what the truth really is. When 18-year-old Zeb Quinn failed to show up at home after his shift, his mother Denise knew something terrible had happened to him. Zeb was not the type to just up and leave without a word. 2 weeks later, his car was found in very odd circumstances. Police followed every lead they received, but the case went cold. It wasn't until 15 years later, after the murder of a completely unattached couple and their unborn child, that a break came in that would finally get some of the answers they were looking for. This is the creepy case of the disappearance of Zeb Quinn.
Thank you.
Rich Mountains of Asheville, North Carolina, to Denise Velasquez. Zeb Quinn was one of two children. He had a sister named Brandy. Now, Zeb was your typical 5'9", 165-pound, 18-year-old with brown hair and blue eyes. He had an organizational learning disability and was known to be somewhat naive. He never really fit in and didn't really have many friends. Now, Zeb did not let that get in the way of his dreams. He had an admirable, ambitious character and was prepared to achieve those dreams under any circumstances. He attended T.C. Robertson High School, where he was enrolled in the Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC as it's kind of better known. And it was here that he finally found something he loved and a place he belonged. He was determined to join the armed forces as a commissioned officer. After he graduated high school, Zeb enrolled in Asheville-Buncombe Technical Community College. He was your typical mountain boy. He loved to fish. He was close with his family. He played pool with his dad at a local bar named Q and Spirits. And he was a mama's boy through and through. His mom, Denise, actually once said in an interview that he wasn't ashamed to show his love and affection for her. Even when they were in public or he had friends around, when most boys his age were embarrassed or thought it would make him look uncool, Zeb didn't care. He was a sweet and thoughtful young man, conscientious, responsible, and reliable. Zeb had been working in the electronics department at the Hendersonville Walmart for 2 years, and he really enjoyed his job, and customers, along with coworkers, loved him. He liked the place so much that he would actually hang out after work and chat, or go in early, and even when he was off the clock. Now, Zeb was saving up to buy a car, which he was super excited about, when 22-year-old coworker Robin Jason Owens, who goes by Jason, told him that he knew of a Mitsubishi Eclipse for sale in nearby Leicester. The two made plans to go check it out after work on Sunday, January 2nd. Now, after his shift, Zeb met Jason in the Walmart parking lot. Each drove their own vehicle, and surveillance cameras show the two stopping at a Citgo where they purchased soft drinks around 9:15 p.m. Now, a few minutes later, the footage shows Jason's Ford pickup truck pulling out of the lot, heading towards Long Shoals Road with Zeb's light blue Mazda Protege following behind. Now, this is the last time Zeb Quinn is said to be seen. And when Zeb didn't show up at home, his mother Denise became worried and called Walmart around 10:30 p.m. asking to speak to Zeb. And she was told that he left around 9 o'clock. Now, Denise was confused because Zeb was not the type to just not check in, especially if his plans had changed. He would always call and let her know if he was going to be home late. Now, he didn't have a curfew, but was always the one to let his mom know where he was going and who he would be with. And that's actually just a good practice for anyone, no matter how old you are, or especially if you're traveling alone. Always let somebody know where you are just in case something happens. I do it with my parents and my family. My daughter does it. But yeah, it's just a good practice. So at this point, Denise actually began paging Zeb every hour or two, but sadly she got no response. So the next morning, Denise and Brandy checked his room. Maybe he had packed some belongings to go camping or on a fishing trip for a couple of days, although she still felt that he would have told her. All of his belongings were still in his room. Clothing, his toothbrush, his contacts stuff, and cash. So at 3 p.m. on January 3rd, Denise filed a missing persons report. And you know what? The police took it. Which I will say this probably every every episode that deals with filing a missing persons report. Police and just common belief is that you have to wait between 24, 48, 72 hours before you can even file the report. That's not true. You can report somebody missing at any time. You don't have to wait. And I'm sorry, and I will say this, and I'm sure there are people out there who will hate me. Make the police take that missing person's report, especially because they tell you the first 48 hours are the most important and the most, like, you need to be going and looking. I don't care if it's an adult, I don't care who, what it is. File the report. Now, a few weeks later, on January 16th, Zeb's Mazda protege was found in the parking lot of Little Pig's Barbecue Restaurant by a former classmate of his and a current co-worker of his mom, Denise. And this is where things get a little odd. Now, the car's headlights were on, so this means that it hadn't really been left like this for very long because the battery would have died. And there was a drawing of a mouth or lips with an exclamation point on the back window in lipstick. And there was also a black Labrador puppy found inside. Now, it was alive, don't worry, and it was adopted by one of the police officers who worked the case. So that's a little ray of sunshine there, at least. Several bottles were found inside the car. There was also a jacket that didn't belong to Zeb, and a key card from a hotel. The police couldn't track where this key card, or like what hotel this key card came from. That was found inside as well. Now, police were told by witnesses that they had seen a woman driving the car around. Also, this restaurant where the car was found wasn't very far from where Denise worked. She worked in a hospital, and it was like right down the road. Police put together a composite sketch of the woman, noting that she looked very similar to a woman named Misty Taylor. And I'm not gonna lie, this composite sketch is a little creepy. No offense to anyone, if this is what they look like, and no offense to the person who drew it. However, it is kind of like, it's a little creepy. I'm not gonna lie. Misty Taylor was someone that Zeb was quite interested in. They had met at a Christmas party for Denise's job, and with blonde curls, a warm smile, Zeb quickly became infatuated with her. And he would actually gush to family and coworkers about the phone conversations that they would have. However, things were a little complicated with the two. You see, people actually warned Zeb to be careful because Misty was in a relationship with someone named Wesley Smith, and they had a child together, and he was actually known to be abusive towards her. But Zeb just could not be swayed, and he persisted in pursuing her. Now, on New Year's Eve, Misty and Zeb actually both stayed home from New Year's parties and talked on the phone. Misty told Zeb about her concerns with Wesley, and after this, for about 2 days, Zeb didn't hear anything from her. So he called her, but he forgot to do star 67, which was the kind of typical thing to mask his phone number. It wasn't Misty who answered, it was actually Wesley. And Zeb hung up very quickly, but he told his grandmother that he made a big mistake. There was actually one time where he showed up to Misty's house unannounced, and Wesley was there and actually threatened Zeb and scared him. Now, this started a long list of confusing clues that police had to deal with, but it's kind of what changed Zeb's case from a missing person to a homicide investigation. Police interviewed Misty and Wesley, but nothing came of it because there was really no evidence to link them. As Jason Owens was the last known person to see Zeb alive, police actually focused on him and he became the prime suspect. Jason Owens told police that he had met Zeb in the Walmart lot, okay, stopped to get drinks, okay, and then headed out again. But Jason says right around 9:30, Zeb, who was following behind him, flashed his lights to kind of tell him pull over. He told Jason that he received a page and needed to find a phone. And Jason said that he seemed pretty desperate to return this call. He said about 10 minutes later, Zeb returned and was visibly frantic. He apologized and said that he needed to cancel the plans to go look at the Mitsubishi Eclipse and told Owens that he had to leave. As Zeb tried to go around him, he actually rear-ended Jason's truck, but it was minor damage, so he said he would pay for it and just kind of kept on his way. He says at this point, this was the last time he had seen Zeb. Okay. Now, he also claims that he admitted himself to the hospital a few hours later with a head injury and cracked ribs from a second accident that happened close by. However, he didn't file any kind of report and there wasn't any evidence of an accident. On January 4th, this was 2 days after Zeb went missing, Patty King, Zeb's manager at Walmart, received a phone call from someone claiming to be Zeb. But Patty had been Zeb's manager for 2 years, and she knew the voice on the other line was not him. So Patty tried to kind of keep the person on the line as long as she could, and she said that, you know, they told her that they were Zeb Quinn, they were sick, and they wouldn't be at work that day. Now, when Patty said, she kind of made up a story and said that the call had been transferred to the wrong department and asked the person what department they worked in, they couldn't answer. They didn't know. Now, after the call, Patty hit star 69 to trace the phone number and called it back. Do you guys remember when star 67 and star 69 were a thing? Like, it's crazy to think before cell phones, like, you had to go through, like, star 67. Oh, you don't know who I am. Star 69. Well, I'm going to find out who you are. So the call was traced back to a Volvo construction equipment plant. And this was when Patty knew that Zeb was in trouble. She immediately called Denise and told her about the strange call. And Denise reported it to the police. And it didn't take long to piece the puzzle together that the caller was a coworker of Zeb who also had a part-time job at Volvo. If you guessed Jason Owens, you'd be correct. Now, when police confronted Jason, he told them that he made the call because Zeb had called him and asked him to. He told them that he didn't know why because he didn't ask. He just thought that maybe Zeb didn't feel like going to work and he was a pal who asked for a favor, right? So he was just helping out. Now, Zeb's family didn't believe a word and neither did police. There was no evidence that Zeb had called him, and he said in an interview with Spin magazine in 2001, quote, "They called me at work. Like, what did you do to him? But I tried to be nice. They want to know. But until they find him alive or find him dead or prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that I didn't do anything, people are always going to think I had something to do with it," end quote. Now, I mean, everything that you've done so far looks super suspicious, so you can't really blame people for thinking that you had a hand in it somehow. Just, you know, my outlook. So, police then visited the Volvo plant. His managers told them on Monday morning, January 3rd, Jason was really late for work. Manager said that he told him he was in a car accident. Police followed this lead to the hospital, where medical staff said they weren't convinced that Jason's injuries were caused by a car accident. They said Jason had driven himself to the hospital and left on his own when he was discharged. He claimed that he was in two car accidents that evening, but when his truck was looked at, sure, it had a couple of dents, but nothing so bad as to explain a head injury and cracked ribs. Now, I will tell you, just, you know, right up front, because there's not much touched on this later, we don't know where his head injury or his cracked ribs came from. They don't really explain what actually happened to him. Now, with no evidence, not even a body, police turned their focus to the page that Zeb had received that night he disappeared. This led them to discover the call had actually come from his aunt, Ina Utich's house. Now, Ina claims she didn't make that call. She wasn't even at home. She was out having dinner with her close friend, Tamra Taylor. Yeah, Misty Taylor's mother. And she says that Misty and Taylor were both present that evening. Now, however, Ina claims later her house had been broken into that night. She said nothing was stolen, but a lot of stuff had been moved around. And Misty and Wesley were talked to again, but denied any involvement. And of course, once again, since there was no solid evidence, nothing could be done. Now, police found it odd that Misty kept downplaying her relationship with Zeb, but they felt that it was most likely due to trying to keep Wesley from kind of going off the deep end or getting mad or, you know, upsetting him, especially since he was abusive. And Denise wasn't actually happy with the friendship. She felt that Zeb had changed quite a bit since becoming involved with her. He lost focus and was just kind of not really the same. Police found Ina's story strange and was wondering if she was possibly hiding something. Could Misty have snuck out and gone to Ina's house to page Zeb to talk to him alone? She was most likely the only person who would have had that kind of effect for him to be so panicked. Him or his mom, and of course his mom hadn't talked to him, so that kind of rules her out. After looking at so many angles, there was just nothing linking Misty or Wesley to the car. There was just no evidence, no fingerprints, no anything. They also tried to link Misty and Wesley to Jason Owens, as they suspected that more than one person was involved in Zeb's disappearance. But the only thing that they had in common was they all knew Zeb. A month after Zeb's disappearance, police took blood, hair, and saliva samples from Jason. And Denise says that she felt very early on that something happened to Zeb, and she knew that if he left on his own, he would have told his family. And she said she felt certain that he was killed that night. So with no new evidence and all leads basically going nowhere, Zeb's case ran cold, but Denise and Brandy refused to stop searching. 5 years later, police did do a reenactment of Zeb's last known movements on the night he disappeared, thinking maybe it would kind of spark attention on the case again, or maybe it would lead them to look somewhere or see something that they hadn't really noticed before. Sadly, nothing came of this, and they were back to where they started. In 2007, Asheville police officially named Jason Owens as a person of interest in Zeb's case, and they had enough evidence to obtain a search warrant for Jason's property in Leicester. They teamed up with a company called NecroSearch, using ground-piercing radar to search the land for remains. Once again, their efforts didn't bring about any evidence to charge Jason. It would be another 2 years before police would take hair, saliva, and fingerprint samples from Misty Taylor, which I feel this should have been done when Zeb first went missing, or at least when witnesses described the woman who was seen driving his car. Now, totally understand, they say that there wasn't any kind of evidence in the car, but I feel like they said she looked really similar, or the description of the woman driving the car fit her so closely. But I also feel like they would kind of want to rule people out anyway, because let's say you found a fingerprint and you don't know whose it is, you haven't even fingerprinted anybody to compare it to. I should be a police officer or a detective. I think I'd be really good at it. Like, I missed my calling with it. Probably. But that's okay. It wasn't until 2015 when an incident totally unrelated to Zeb reignited his case. On March 15th, 2015, Bill Schoen called Buncombe County Police reporting his daughter, Christy Schoen Codd, who was pregnant at the time, missing because she didn't show up for a planned visit to Mississippi. Now, sheriff deputies arrived at the home Christy shared with her husband, Joseph J.T. Codd, on Hooker Gap Road to do a welfare check. Now, both cars were in the driveway, but the couple was nowhere to be seen. The home had been ransacked, and the two dogs inside had been clearly unattended to. Christy's purse and JT's wallet were found inside, making police wonder if the home had actually been burglarized or if it was set up to look that way. Because why would you leave basically the two main sources of money in the home almost untouched? They suspected that something had happened to the couple. Now, if the name Christy Schoen Codd sounds familiar, it's because you may have heard it on Food Network Star when she was a contestant during season 8. The couple had recently moved to North Carolina from Los Angeles, which they felt was a big change, but they also thought that the mountains was going to be the perfect place to raise a family. And Christy was pregnant with a little baby girl that they were going to name Skylar. Now, later that same evening, around 8:30 p.m., someone called to report a man throwing garbage bags into a private dumpster outside of a Chandler home. Upon retrieval, those bags contained items belonging to Christy. The man who threw them in there? If you guessed Jason Owens again, you'd be correct. This man gets around. Now, Jason was 34 years old at the time, and he lived on an acre about really only a mile from Christy and JT, and he knew the couple as he had done some renovation work on some of their properties. On March 16th, police questioned Jason, and he denied knowing anything about the couple being missing. He claimed that he had stolen from them, yes, but he got rid of the items which he felt had no value. But that's all he knew. Once again, police didn't believe his story and pressed him to tell the truth. And he finally did. Jason told investigators on March 10th, JT's truck got stuck at a nearby creek, and he was just trying to be neighborly and tried to help. Now, due to a previous conviction, he wasn't supposed to drive, but figured, you know, he'd be fine since it wasn't on a public road, and he wasn't really going to drive anyway. He was just trying to help get the truck out of the mud or whatever. He hopped into the driver's seat while JT and Christy stood in front to push the truck backwards. Jason said that he thought he'd shifted the gear into reverse, but when he pressed the gas, the truck lurched forward, striking and running over Christy and JT. And, you know, when I was first researching this and even kind of like typing this up, I didn't put it really together, but why would Jason have hopped into the driver's seat? Wouldn't he? I mean, like, usually the owner of the vehicle hops in, and then the other people kind of help, and, I don't know, something else
I definitely missed my calling.
So after this, he jumped out of the car, finding JT unresponsive, but he said Christy looked okay, so he carried her into the house to try to help her, but she died on the living room floor. And when Jason went back to check on JT, he found him dead as well. Jason told them that this was when he panicked. It was an accident, but he knew that if he reported it, he'd go back to jail. So he took both of the bodies back to his trailer, where he kept them until he decided what to do with them. He also admitted that on March 11th, he dismembered both bodies and burnt the body parts in a wood stove. Now, Jason was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, murder of an unborn child, and breaking and entering. Later, they added the charge of dismembering human remains. Now, they searched the property again, finding bone fragments in the stove. They also collected a saw blade, 11 knives, a tow strap, an extension cord, and some debris from the yard. So now that they knew Jason was capable of murder and disposing of human remains, they wondered if maybe he had actually murdered Zeb Quinn. And could he possibly know where his remains were? Now, before they could search for any possible evidence on Zeb's case, a fire was set on Jason's property. And while there's not really much more to that, it was ruled arson. An anonymous tip told police that in January 2000, Jason had dug up a pit on his property to dispose of items by burning them, and not long after he had filled it in with concrete. Now, when the person asked, Jason said he was making a fish pond, but never completed it. He filled it in with dirt, and they showed him the place where he had put this, and police felt it was a really odd spot to put a fish pond. Now, they brought in cadaver dogs, which led them to several plastic bags containing an unknown white powder. It was believed to be either pulverized lime or mortar mix. They also picked up some unknown hard fragments believed to be human bone, fabric, and the piece of leather that was discovered under a layer of concrete. Police were optimistic. If Zeb was there, they'd most likely find it in the evidence collected. Now, a few months later, police actually searched a specific area of Bent Creek Experimental Forest, and officials wouldn't disclose why or what had led them there. In April 2017, Robert Jason Owens stood trial for the murders of Christy and JT, along with their unborn child. Zeb's family attended the trial to show their support for the other families. Jason Owens pled guilty to avoid the death penalty, and he was sentenced 59 to 74 years in prison without the possibility of parole. 3 months after the trial, Jason Owens was indicted on the first-degree murder of Zeb Quinn. Now, he insisted that he was innocent, but he knew who killed Zeb. A letter wrote to a neighbor in 2016 claims that he watched his uncle, Walter Eugene Owens, murder Zeb Quinn. Amy Carson says that she has a hard time believing this. This was the neighbor that he wrote it to. But she says that she has a hard time believing this because Jason is a known pathological liar. And she says that if it was an accident, then he should have reported it. Jason wrote in the letter that he lived in fear of Gene since 2000 when he watched him shoot Zeb, then dismember and burn his body. Does this sound familiar? Maybe a little bit. But it's also known that Jason lived in Gene's trailer. And I get that sometimes we live with people we fear, that's not any kind of reason not to live with them. And sometimes it's basically the only reason you live with someone is because you fear them and you don't know what they'll do if you try to go your own way. But I do find it odd because Jason's brother actually placed a restraining order against him, Gene, that is, at one point in time to stay away from him and Jason. So I find that a little odd. Now, Gene Owens passed away in 2017, but prior to this, he had denied any involvement in the murder and actually gave investigators information that implicated Jason in the murder of Zeb. And it was a common belief that Jason had the motive of robbery because he knew Zeb had money on him because he was taking him to possibly buy a car. However, as we all know, when you have no body or any kind of remains, it's really, really hard to prosecute a murder case. Now, Jason claimed a friend of Wesley Smith hired Gene to take care of Zeb. However, that friend of Wesley Smith died in 2006 and couldn't be interviewed. And I find it kind of convenient that everyone that Jason's kind of pointing the finger at has died and isn't here to defend themselves. Now, Jason submitted a 5-page confession of what happened that fateful night. And I'm not going to read the entire thing. There's actually, I could only find 3 pages of it, so I could only get, you know, the first 3 pages anyway. However, I'll give you the basic layout from Jason's perspective. And I will warn you that some of the details are disturbing. So just to kind of give you that disclaimer in case you want to either skip this part or if obviously it's, you know, what we want to hear, not disturbing details, but we want to hear what happened or, you know, his version of what happened. But just to let you know, some of the details are a little heeh. So it's marked Sunday afternoon, January 1st, 2000. Gene came to the house while I was washing my truck. He asked if I knew Zeb from Walmart, and I told him yes. We had gone fishing a few times. He told me that Zeb was talking to this girl, Misty, who had a jealous boyfriend, and Misty wanted Zeb to come up to Lake Powhatan, where she was camping, that night. He asked me if I could get him. I said sure. He said to meet on the dirt road that night, right before the lake. I told him I thought camping wasn't allowed. He said it was posted but never enforced. That night, I went to Walmart and told Zeb. He said, okay, told me about Misty, her baby, and the boyfriend who mistreated her and had threatened him a week before. He told me they were supposed to get a Gatlinburg the next day. I told him I would meet him after work and we would go find where she was camping. Now, I'm sure you've realized by now, this is a completely different story than what he originally told police, that he would be taking Zeb to look at a car. After he, meaning Zeb, got off, we left heading up there, stopping for drinks at the gas station. Since we got to the dirt road, we had to drive forever before we seen anyone. Finally, we seen my Uncle Gene's truck. I pulled past him and backed in beside him. Zeb left his car in the road and came over. Gene went to the back of his truck. I asked where Misty was, and he says she would be there in a minute. Zeb turned his head, looking down the trail, when Gene pulled out a .22 rifle and shot him in the back of the head. Zeb spun and dropped. I took off around my truck, jumped in, and threw it in drive. And as I punched the gas pulling out, I hit Zeb's car. My head hit the steering wheel. Before I could back up to clear Zeb's car, Gene ran around to my driver's side yelling, "Whoa, whoa, I'm not going to shoot you." And I seen his hands were empty. I asked, "Why did you shoot him?" Gene said he was poking his nose somewhere he shouldn't be, and someone had to teach him a lesson. He told me, don't think about calling the cops because I was an accomplice, and the gun that he used was a stolen .22 that Aunt Sarah had traded Mom, and he knew that my fingerprints were on it too. He told me to go home and make sure Mom knew what time it was when I got there. I went home, I went to bed, but I couldn't sleep. At 3 a.m., I got up and headed to work. On the way, I rode back to see if he left Zeb just laying there. I saw Zeb's car, but didn't see Zeb. I drove around the curve and saw Gene's truck. I saw Gene a little further and a big campfire behind him. I pulled in and Gene motioned for me to get out of the truck. When I did, I seen Zeb's legs hanging out of the campfire. Gene told me, I see you've come to roast marshmallows with me. I said no, needed to get on to work. He told me I had to stay until he was finished. I told him I had to be at work by 6, and he said he didn't care. I had to stay however long it took. So I sat on a rock. Gene kept trying to make small talk. He went to his truck and grabbed a basket. Then he went to the creek several times, putting out the coals. He got a shovel and threw the wet ashes down into the woods, picking up a piece of skull with teeth still attached, and took it to the creek to hide underwater so dogs couldn't pick up on the scent. He had me call in for Zeb, and I told him I probably didn't have a job because Volvo had a no-call, no-show, no-job policy, and he had forced me to stay there. He then told me to go to urgent care and get a doctor's note, so I had an excuse for why I was late to work. Now, when they searched the area, no remains were found. Zeb's family and the detectives noted that this was the first time anyone had established that Zeb had actually been murdered. And July 8th was when this confession was submitted, and according to his death certificate, Gene Owens died that same day at Park Ridge Hospital in Hendersonville from cardiac arrest at 66 years old. He probably had a heart attack from his nephew blaming him for the murder, in my opinion. I'm not being sarcastic, you never know. On July 10th, Jason Owens was charged with the murder of Zeb Quinn. However, July 25th, 2022, he pled guilty to accessory, and prosecuting attorney Tom Williams dropped the murder charge. Now, he was sentenced to 189 months, and that's actually, he's going to serve it with the sentence he's currently serving. And it's really hard to believe anything that Jason Owens says because his story changed so much that I feel that maybe he was involved more than he says. I don't think he was just the accessory part, just because he knew so much and he lied for so long, but also he murdered other people and I hate to use the word, but disposed of their bodies and their remains in the same exact way that Zeb Quinn, that he claims happened to Zeb Quinn. So it's just a little odd. And I don't know. I just find it to be a little too convenient that all of this happened and he didn't have anything to do with it. But also, and I'm not saying that Gene was completely innocent, but he gave police like information that would have, that basically, led the police to him. So it's kind of one of those things where it's like, was he just trying to get the heat off of him and get Jason for it? Or did Jason actually do it? And Gene was telling the truth and being like, hey, that's your guy. In 2022, Todd Williams said, quote, Zeb would have been 41 this year. It was always the hope of investigators and the DA's office that more facts and details would be uncovered. While we may never know the full truth, these many years after Zeb's disappearance, my sympathies are with the family and all who suffered as a result, end quote. Denise also made a statement at Zeb's trial stating that Zeb was a good kid and he never turned his back on anyone. He was someone who would have trusted anyone and would have never seen his death coming. Now, I find it really sad that this happened. I mean, all murder is sad, you know, but just to happen to such a sweet, ambitious, loving kid who really just wanted the best for himself and everyone else, and over such a trivial thing as just liking a girl. Like, I think it's just absolutely ridiculous that he was murdered just because he liked a girl. And it's just really sad when things like that happen to people who are just, they're just living their life. And I also find that Misty, even if she didn't have a hand in it, she was like, don't lead him on. Don't act like you're interested in him. Don't sit here and have his hopes up and get him, you know, excited about maybe having a relationship with you if you don't want a relationship with him. So we'll never know, well, the full truth as to what happened to Zeb that night. And hopefully we got the right guy and he's the one in prison. And it's just another tragedy to add to the list for the family, because while there's a little bit of justice, I guess, we don't know if there's full justice, because maybe Wesley Smith should also, maybe Misty Taylor, we don't know, were they accessories as well? But on that note, I will see you next crime. You've been listening to Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces, a Pizza and Pigtails production. Created and hosted by Cassie Opea. All episodes researched, written, and edited by yours truly. Don't forget, you can find new episodes of the creepiest and spookiest content every Friday on your favorite podcast listening platform, and now YouTube as well. Subscribe to the Patreon page or the anchor.fm page for as little as $5 a month for bonus episodes every other Tuesday, a merchandise discount, and a Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces thank you swag box. You can also support without subscribing through the Cash App and Venmo. Don't forget to follow along on social media, especially the Facebook and the Instagram page at creepycases.spookyspaces for all future news and updates related to the podcast, and maybe see some content that's not featured here. Like, comment, and share with your fellow fiends to get that conversation started. And on that note, I'll see you next crime.